Hi, this is Joe Castellano. Welcome to the Inside China Basin Baseball Podcast on thesportsvirus.com, featuring players like all-star catcher Buster Posey.
It's about, you know, just going out and trying to have passion for the game that I've loved since I was a kid.
Inside China Basin is brought to you by TPC Harding Park, the only public golf course in San Francisco offering golfers the opportunity to play where the pros play. We're also brought to you by Houseboats.com, your home for houseboat rentals on Shasta Lake. On the last Giants homestand, I had a chance to sit down with former Major League umpire and current umpire supervisor Ed Montague. I also chatted with Giants relief pitcher Mark Melanson. You'll hear those conversations in just a moment, but first, I want to tell you about my favorite golf course, TPC Harding Park in San Francisco. Live in San Francisco and love to play golf? Visit TPC Harding Park and purchase your two-year resident card, giving you immediate savings on golf and other programs at the park. Cut your green fees in half by purchasing your card today. Visit www.tpc.com/Harding Park for more information. During the Giants' last homestand at Oracle Park, I had a chance to chat with Giants right-handed reliever Mark Melanson. Here was that conversation. Mark, first off, just you and how you feel about the way you've been pitching this year and how much more pleasing it is just to be out there healthy and throwing the ball the way you like to throw it.
I feel really good. I kind of feel like a little kid again just having my arm back. So it's been awesome. Feel great. And, yeah, I like where I'm at.
And you guys have talked, I know I talked to Tony Watson about it too, about how there's pretty good camaraderie in the bullpen. Can you describe that and how much you guys have maybe helped some of the younger guys come along in the, on the pitching staff?
It's nice to have, you know, everybody working in the right direction. And you know, guys are excited for people that are doing well. And, you know, it just makes things easier when everybody's on the same page and rooting in the same direction. And we have an older group here. It's you know, I think it's well known that we know what we're doing down here.
You know, there have been a lot of changes on this team. The roster seems to constantly change. How has that affected you guys? You know, and how do you deal with that as a team? Because, you know, it's kind of hard, it would seem, to have chemistry team-wide when the roster keeps changing.
I think that's just normal throughout baseball. The turnover is crazy. You know, you look at the beginning of a season to the last day of a season, and most rosters have changed quite a bit. You know, it's rare to see that few moves are made, you know.
One of the things I noticed about, you know, Jeff Samardzija, when he had a couple, you know, tough defensive plays behind him where it didn't work out for him, he didn't hang his head. And, you know, that's the mark of a veteran guy. So how do you look at that? You know, if that happens to you, maybe the defensive play isn't made that you'd like, but you still bounce back. How do you get back into the mental frame of mind that you need to be in?
Well, in those times, you got to remember the law of averages. And, you know, there's a ball may get by somebody or may go through the shift, but there's other times where, you know, that shift makes up for something that normally would have been a hit. So you just got to trust what everybody's doing and understand that sometimes it's not always going to go your way.
Yeah, I was going to say, those shifts sometimes, you know, depending on how you're working a hitter and depending on, you know, how that guy hits you, it could be kind of mind-boggling. I guess it would be too much for you to be out there directing traffic, but sometimes is there, you know, are there times where you say, man, I wish that guy was in this spot because that's kind of where I pitched him?
Well, I think more often than not, the shift helps us. So, you know, it's just, you know, Ronnie Wotus does a great job. Our analytics team does a great job. And there's a lot of hard work that goes into it. You can't predict the future, but you can look at the odds and place guys in certain areas that make sense.
You said that, you know, you're feeling great. What do you think are some of the differences to getting the hitters out? I mean, are you getting more movement on your cutter? You know, what's been happening that you've noticed this year that's really helping you out to be successful?
Well, I think the ability to, you know, let loose and let the arm work like it should and not have pain behind it makes a lot of difference.
More of life on your fastball because of that? More movement on the other pitches too?
You know, I don't know if the metrics would say that, but I think it's that last, you know, anytime your brain feels pain, it's going to it's going to have some hesitancy behind there, and that's what I had, you know, previous years. So to not have that, I think it frees you up.
I did want to ask you about the metrics. How much do you look at it? And are there times where you have to back away from metrics because it get to be a little bit too mind-boggling?
I think it's learning how and what numbers to take in. There's a lot of stuff that's out of your control, and if you're trying to control those things, it becomes way too much. But there's a lot of things that can help and change, you know, maybe in the direction you're on. So I think it's important. I think it's the education part of the game is extremely important, and I think that's how guys can separate themselves if they know what to look for and how to use the information that we have, because there is so much of it.
The hitter's metrics, how much do you look at an overall hitter's metrics and maybe compare it to what a guy's been doing against you in the past or what he's done against you more recently?
It's hard as a reliever. You know, we don't have the sample size that, say, a starter does. And like I said earlier, the turnover is great, so we're facing new guys quite often. And if you only have 3, 4, 5, 6 at-bats against a guy, it's not necessarily enough to be concrete in what you do in facing them. But, you know, overall sample size with right-handed pitchers, you know, I kind of isolate it down to that and similar guys and, you know, look at the broad scope and then kind of narrow it down according to kind of the who I am as a pitcher.
Okay, the last thing, when you go on a long road trip like you're going to Miami, Baltimore, New York, how do you go about that? I mean, does that sort of help a team in a way? And even you as an individual, you get out on the road, maybe there's not as many distractions as at home. How do you compare it and try to make that a positive when it's a long road trip like that?
I don't really view it as a negative thing. You know, being at home is great. It's able to be with the family and the kids and wife, and you know, we're familiar with our ballpark and you know, we got the home crowd and all that stuff, and that's great. And then when you go on the road, you kind of use that as your advantage too in different ways. So I don't view either one being a negative by any means. Yeah,
but it's never easy to be away from family, I guess. I mean, you kind of, a family gets used to that because you're a major league player, but it's never easy, is it, to be away for that long?
No, not easy by any means, and none of it is so to speak easy. But you know, I feel fortunate to be able to do this. So I'm you know, I don't take it for granted. If we have to go on the road, it's a positive. If we're at home, that's even a bigger positive. You know, it's a beautiful thing that we get to do, play a game and enjoy it. So. Yeah, there's a lot of difficult things that can go into this, and day in and day out, we play 162 games. It's going to be difficult. We're going to have bad days, and but you know, you need to turn the page and just realize how fortunate we are. I think the perspective changes a lot.
Mark, thanks a lot for the time, and good luck.
No problem. Thank you.
That's Giants right-hander Mark Melancon. Coming up, we'll hear from Major League Baseball umpire supervisor Ed Montague right after this. When it comes to Giants baseball, family memories are created one summer at a time. And the same can be said for your family vacation. How about an experience you will never forget? Shasta Lake is one of the most beautiful places to visit in California, and there is no better way to experience it than to rent a houseboat from houseboats.com. Jones Valley and Silverthorne Resorts are located on the Pitt River arm of Shasta Lake, unquestionably the very best area of Shasta Lake, and houseboats.com will set you up there with rentals ranging from the finest and largest houseboats available for rent in California to entry-level models for small groups or those new to houseboating. Houseboats.com has the best service, the best boats, and the best locations. Let's get that vacation planned. Call 877-468-7326 or go to houseboats.com today. Now it's time for the conversation I had with Major League Baseball umpire supervisor and former Major League umpire, Ed Montague. Ed, we're here at Oracle Park, and you're out at a lot of the games. So what's the latest that you're looking at as far as, you know, making sure the umpires get better at their job and you know, being an umpire supervisor? I'm sure there's always a lot to look at, but what's maybe some of the trends that you guys are seeing?
Well, our guys really do a good job. But when you talk about plays on the bases and behind the plate, I mean, they're scoring in the upper 90%. When we see, talk about trends, when we see somebody like in the low 90s, we look for pitches that they're calling. Maybe the other day I saw somebody had a lot of, not a lot, but missed calls on left-hand batters just going off the plate. And that's always been something where umpires, for some reason, off the plate a little bit on lefties. Not both my sons are left-hand hitters, so I understand they always complain to me. But, you know, those are the things we look at, and then we try to tweak it, and these guys do a great job.
You know, when you first started umpiring, you didn't have this technology. So, I mean, a lot of it was based on, you know, the players might be arguing with you, but you had to know in your heart, and maybe there's other umpires looking at it, you had to know what you were doing as far as evaluating it. Now, I mean, you've got so much going on as far as the analytics are concerned. How does that affect an umpire mentally, you think?
Well, like I said, we try to keep their morale up and stuff, and they're all very conscientious about the job they do on the field. I know when I first came up, there weren't even cell phones. So, but we did have, later on, we got the VCRs and the late 70s and stuff, and I used to critique my games all the time. If I had a play, you know, I'd get the VCR and I'd look at that over and over again. I'd look at my positioning, and if it didn't have that, a lot of times I worked with Lee Wire for 13 years. He was my crew chief on the field, and we had a good rapport, and if he saw me doing something like maybe getting down too low on pitches or moving on a pitch, you know, he'd come in and tell me.
You talked about the positioning, and that's such a key. And I don't think the camera angles can always capture what's going on some of the calls, whereas sometimes an umpire, I mean, he's in perfect position. Do you sometimes feel that way? You know, yeah, we're going to rely on the video, but maybe the umpire has that best view that's even sometimes better than whatever the camera angle is.
Yeah, and that's why a lot of times you'll see with replays, you know, we have confirmed and stands, and you'll see stands when the camera can't tell. The umpire, the plays are so close. You know, I try to tell these guys, you know, it's tough to beat the camera with these super slow-mos, and you'll see a guy a fraction of an inch off the bag. Well, you're not going to see that. So when they mark you down for an incorrect call, I always put in capital letters super slow-mo, you know, just to remind them that, hey, it's tough to beat the camera.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to freeze it. They're going to slow it down. They're going to do all these things. And it's the speed of the game that I would think is – the biggest challenge for an umpire. I mean, was that for you, maybe not so much the balls and strikes, but sometimes when you saw plays happening so fast and you had to react to it?
Not really. It just, you know, I came up at a young age, so, and I grew up around a game of baseball. So it was all, you know, the close plays are tough. I think the toughest play an umpire has is a swipe tag, check swing, stuff like that. But, when I came out of the minor leagues, yeah, you noticed it speeded up a little bit. These guys are a lot better athletes, and you know, so you just learn to adjust.
I'm glad you mentioned the swipe tag, because now with video, it seems like as a player, you've got to be really on top of making sure you get the tag and you're on the base. I mean, whereas I think, you know, years ago, maybe you can get away with it a little bit. You know, we talk about the phantom double play and that. You can't really get away with anything now with video, right?
Yeah, if you watch, though, they always said the phantom double play. A lot of times when I was working second base and stuff, you hear that guy swipe with his spikes, and on TV, you know, it looks like he missed the bag. Now it shows, you know, these guys are hitting the bag. Very seldom do you see a guy not hit the bag. Like I say, the swipe tags, that's a matter of angles and stuff, and that's always going to be, I think, an umpire's toughest play. So,
call it first base. I understand that it's you're watching the glove and listening to the bag. Am I wrong about that, or is it just the opposite? How does that work? And when a guy dives into head first into first base, does that make it a little more difficult because you're conditioned to listen to one and watch the other?
No, I think when he dives, I think it makes it easier. You know, you see his hand a little better instead of running through the bag. I think if they're better off running through the bag myself. But Yeah, when you're at a park with 50, 60,000 people, you know, it's tough to hear the ball hit the glove. And I remember that. I was working in the World Series in 91 with the Braves and Twins, and I remember being at first base, and that crowd was so loud in Atlanta. Well, what I had to do then was back up so I see the big picture. You know, I can't rely on, you know, that sound, that pop, and then the two pops. So you just backed up a little bit and, you know, took it into, you know, perspective.
But if you can rely on it, which one are you watching the bag and listening to the glove, or which way do you go, or does it depend?
Yeah, you know what, and you can't get too close to play, so you got to get back, and we call that an umpire having good distance, good angles. So you get the proper distance, you're going to be close enough to hear that pop, but not too close enough to let this play blow up on you.
Because the glove and the baseball is louder than the foot hitting the bag, right? Is that why you would listen to that?
Yeah, at times. That's like I say, when you see a pitcher lobbing the ball over there, that makes it a tough play. And right then, I've got to back up. I've got to back up and see that. You know, just keep focused on the bag. But if I back up, I'm going to get a better shot at the whole thing.
One of the things about you is that not only were you an umpire, but you're a big sports fan and a big baseball fan. And, I mean, you were telling me that you still keep some of the scorecards. How much did that sort of add to what you were doing in your job? Because, you know, you're focused on it being the arbiter of the game, but also you really enjoyed the athletes that were on the field and what was going on.
Yeah, you enjoyed the good plays. And, you know, I came up when Pete Rose, Mike Schmidt, and those guys, as I say, I was looking through some of the scorecards or the lineup cards that I still have. And the great pitchers, Steve Carlton and Tom Seaver. But you're focused on a job out there. But, you know, I remember working a game with Tom Seaver pitching, and it always stands out in my mind. He struck out about 16 or 17 Pittsburgh Pirates, and that's when Stargell and Dave Parker, and they had a great team, Rennie Stennett. And that stood out in my mind, you know, after the game, and you're able to look back at it and stuff like that. But for the most part, you're out there trying to do a job. People used to say, when you're watching a pitcher, you know, how do you throw or what do you do? I don't really remember. I was trying to concentrate on the strike zone.
Exactly. You know, these days with replay, there's not as many arguments. And I used to enjoy watching the arguments. But as an umpire, how did you handle that mentally? Because it had to be hard. You got two different sides. You know, neither side's going to be happy at all times with a close call. And you have to know that you made the right call. But you got people that are trying to argue with you. So how did you deal with it?
I had no problem. My first year in the league, I think I had 17 ejections. The next year it was about 16. You know, they test you as a young umpire. And as it goes on, they figured I was nuts, so they left me alone. But I had no problem dealing with it. You had certain managers that come out a lot. You know, Bobby Cox, I always said, was one of our toughest guys. But Bobby's the type of guy, and I love Bobby Cox. I mean, I tossed him a lot of times. We had great nose-to-nose battles. But Bobby was the type of guy that you toss him out of a ball game, and if I'm in the parking lot in Atlanta and I had a flat tire that night, he'd help me change the tire. So not all of them were like that, but, you know, so it was, and I didn't mind the arguments. I mean, sometimes, you know, I got into them too, so I was old school.
Now, the best sporting event I've ever been to was Game 6 of the 1986 World Series, the Bill Buckner game. And I know you were there. You got to tell our listeners who haven't heard the story about, you know, what transpired there. You know, that place was going crazy, Shea Stadium. It was so improbable. I mean, they were down two runs in the 10th inning. They had two outs. They had nobody on base. They had two strikes. The next thing you know, after Gary Carter gets on, just all heck breaks loose. And they win the game when the ball goes between the legs of Buckner. Tell us about your perspective that day.
Well, you know, I'm in right field. John Kibler was working first base that day, game six. So, you know, we figured it was over. We're going home. And here's the ball hit to Buckner and through the legs. I think he might have just peeked at Mookie Wilson coming down the line. But when it went through his legs, I saw the end of the game, and Marty Barrett was a second baseman for Boston. He was coming over to pick up the ball. I said, Marty, I've got it. So I picked up the ball and put it in my pocket. After the game, I put a little mark on the ball, just a little dot, and I left it in my coat pocket. And after game seven, Mets came back and won it. So a good friend of ours, Arthur Richman, who worked for the Mets, and then he also went on to work for the Yankees, wonderful man. So when Arthur came in, you know, and congratulated us on a nice series. I said, Arthur, I said, I've got something for you. I said, this is the ball that won it for you. This is the ball that went through Buckner's legs. And he didn't want to take it. And so a couple years later, he calls me back and he says, you mind if we auction it off for charity? I said, no, I gave you the ball. Do what you want with it. And my wife and I are watching ESPN that night, and they said their ball just sold for a record dollar amount, $93,000, the ball that went through Buckner's legs. So that was a story.
You could have made all that money, but, you know, you were being a nice guy and making sure that the Mets had that.
Oh, I've given a lot of stuff away, and people ask me about that ball. I said, if I had that ball, it'd probably be sitting up in my attic with a lot of other balls, you know, so... It went to good, and Arthur donated all that money to charity, so it went to good use.
That was the most surprising ending to a game, though, wasn't it? I mean, it didn't look like there was any way they were going to come back, and then they win it.
Well, you never know. Like Marty Worry says, it's a mosaic, this game of baseball. And you never know what's going to happen in baseball. I've seen some crazy things. You know, you can see that score last night, 18 runs, 18-2. I mean, I've had games like that where guys have come back. Not that big, but... But big games where you figure it's over. And all of a sudden they come back and win. So you never know in this game.
It's a great game. Thanks a lot, Ed. Really appreciate it. And enjoy your time here at Oracle Park.
Okay, thanks, Joe.
That's Major League Baseball umpire supervisor Ed Montague. I want to thank him and Giants right-hander Mark Melancon for being our guest at Oracle Park. Join us again next week for another edition of Inside China Basin. For now, I'm Joe Castellano. Thanks for listening on thesportsvirus.com.